Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
There, that's practically the extent of my German. Hi.
Mein Gott.
I'm Mark Shea. I know how to say welcome, my friend. Willkommen, mein Freund. Hi, you're probably wondering who I am. Well, I'll tell you. I'm Mark Shea, and you're listening to Connecting the Dots. You probably already knew that because you're listening to Connecting the Dots. But at any rate, here we are on this fine Tuesday afternoon. We are, you know, I got a friend who's living in Colorado, and they're like just getting over snow. I'm watching other people in other parts of the country still struggling with snow, but here it's like 80 degrees and sunny. The bees are buzzing in the cherry trees, and it's just a splendid, beautiful day in April.
Oh, so, it's even nice in New Jersey. Stop acting like you live in paradise.
Well, you know, you live in the Garden State, so
that's right. I live in the swamps of the Garden State.
Okay. I'm not, when I think of New Jersey, the word garden doesn't normally spring to mind, but I'm going to go.
Oh, it's mostly, it's got the largest unbroken primeval wilderness in the country, actually. Where I live, the Pine Barrens, has some of the oldest examples of flora that have been discovered. Stuff they thought was extinct before they found it here.
Plus the terrifying Jersey Devil.
Plus the terrifying non-existent Jersey Devil, which usually comes from what else you find in the Pine Barrens, which is pineys, who do a lot of brewing of their own special medicine.
Ah, I see. Pineys.
Pineys, okay. Pineys, yeah. Pineys are like, are basically Jersey hillbilly folk.
I was going to say, Cletus the slack-jawed yokel.
Yeah, no, Cletus the slack-jawed yokel would be like their Einstein.
Okay. Okay, well, see, that's, you learn so much. The more you know. You
know. Yeah, I actually live on the town on the edge of, you know, vast fields of untapped wilderness.
Well, that's good to know. And you know what? I live on the other side of that forest.
Yeah. Except ours burns all the time.
Yeah?
Oh, yes. You can smell it burning during the summer. There's always little forest fires.
Well, as long as it's not like an everlasting, you know, tire fire.
Yes, it's the tire fire of the pines.
Which, you know, which also kind of, when I think of New Jersey, I mean, what can I say? I have a friend who, he's a Brit. He came here years ago. Back in the 90s for a visit, he emailed me and said, "Hey, I'm coming to America, and I thought that I would stop and visit you while I'm there." I said, "Okay." So we went down to SeaTac Airport here in Seattle and picked him up. He comes staggering off the plane, exhausted, and says, "My conference was in Washington, D.C. I had no idea how big the United States was." Someone probably should have warned him that Washington State and Washington, D.C. are not what you would call adjacent.
And that every state has a Washington in it.
Yes. So he gets off the plane and comes out here and was staggered by the size of the U.S. And people can forget that, just how big this country is.
Yeah, which is too big, really. I think we need to break it up into two or three little countries. I think we'd be a lot better off, frankly.
Okay, and I'm willing to be dictator of the,
sure,
the West Coast. I have big plans.
Yeah.
So I started that story for a purpose, but I can't tell you what it was now. So we'll just leave it there. I was leading to another story, but now I can't remember what.
But I rudely interrupted your train of thought.
I don't know. It was going to be great, but now it's forever.
No, I totally believe that, actually, knowing you. It was going to be an awesome one.
It was. So, it's going to be a great story.
What's new in the world of Big C Catholicism?
Well, you know, this is Arcana Tuesday, because you're here. I want to give the people what they want. And my listeners on Tuesdays are expecting at least some piece of
arcana.
Fascinating Catholic arcana. So here's your arcana. This is right up there with, this is 40 in time stuff.
Oh yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, it's great stuff. So most people have heard of the Shroud of Turin.
Sure.
Shroud of Turin is this cloth that has an image on it, which about 100 years ago, some guy went and took a picture of the image with the relatively new technology we call photography. And when he developed the negative, he was gobsmacked to discover that there was a positive image on the cloth of this guy who bears all the wounds of Christ.
Right.
Including things that most people didn't know. So you'll notice that most medieval... What happened was crucifixion, for understandable reasons, once the Roman Empire became Christian... Christians felt funny about continuing crucifying people. It just made them feel uncomfortable. So they banned crucifixion. Well, once you ban crucifixion, one of the things that starts being lost is the knowledge of what crucifixion actually looks like. So almost all post-Roman art depicting the crucifixion of Jesus places the nails in the palms of Jesus' hands. Well, it turns out nobody who knew their work in the Roman Empire did that because the bones in a human hand are not sufficient to support the weight of the body on the cross. So the nail was actually driven through the wrist, which most people...
Well, high on the wrist, kind of.
Right.
Heel. Yeah.
Yeah, which most people just didn't know. Except the shroud depicts somebody who has had nails driven through their wrists, which is... remarkable. And in addition to that, there are all kinds of other things about the shroud. But the main one simply being, how the heck did that image get there?
Right.
Nobody knows. And I constantly hear people say, this is a medieval forgery. And the reason they say that is because it first shows up in the records in France in the 1340s. A crusader knight has it, and he basically says he got it in the Holy Land. But that's the first time it shows up in the records, and because we are a text-centric society, we have this notion that the first time somebody writes about something is the first time it ever existed.
Right. go ahead. I have a story later. We're going to come back to this. Remember that point because later on we've got
textocentrism. We'll remember that. So anyway, one of the things that people have discovered is the blood stains on the shroud. That's real blood, real human blood. It's also the kind of cloth that it is a kind of cloth that was commonly used in the Holy Land. There's all kinds of pollen embedded in the cloth that provide us with kind of a history of where this thing has been. And one of the places it's been is, surprise, the Holy Land. Because it's got pollen from plants that are only from there. It was somebody did a carbon dating on it back in '88 and rushed to the press to announce that this thing is only about 700 years old.
Right.
Well, there are all kinds of problems with that carbon dating test.
This is the second pin we're going to put in this. Remember carbon dating when we
carbon
come
dating
out.
And
that's another important point. Written history and carbon dating. Yes, right. There's a lot of problems with the carbon dating.
Right. So anyway, my belief about it has always been this thing is the genuine article. Anybody that says it's a medieval forgery, Here you go. Here's my challenge to anybody that says it's a medieval forgery. Make another one.
Oh, I find them online all the time. There's a guy who like shows himself using flour and like Iron Man action figure to
bake
himself.
Yeah, but those things are to the real shroud as carob is to chocolate. I mean, you look at it and go, this doesn't look anything like the shroud.
No, and it's that way it wouldn't survive the microscopic test because the imprint is very deep on the fibers of the shroud and very strange. It's a strange imprint.
It's one of the weirdest things in the world. Now, having said all that, my attitude toward it is the same as my attitude toward all specimens of private revelation, which is if you don't think that it's the real thing, well, you know, okay, great, knock yourself out. So I believe it's the real thing in the same way that I believe that John Wilkes Booth shot Abraham Lincoln, because that's where all the facts point. Right. This thing is the burial shroud of Christ. And of course, for a lot of people, it's an aid to faith, which is what private revelation is supposed to be. It's supposed to point us back to the public revelation. Well, what was discovered this week, somebody pointed out that there's not just the Shroud of Turin that is associated with the burial of Christ. There's also something called, which a lot of people haven't heard of, called the Sudarium of Oviedo.
Right. Sudarium is shroud, basically.
Oh, right. It's another way of saying shroud. Oh,
hey, we're already up against the break.
We're up against the break, but we'll be back with more of the arcane, the mysterious, the strange. Here on Connecting the Dots with our co-host Tom McDonald. I'm your host Mark Shea, and we will be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Tom McDonald, and we're having our daily Tuesday, or our Tuesday dose of
Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Catholic Arcana.
And, I'll be Jack Palance. You could be Leonard Nimoy. How's that?
Believe it or not. So anyway, before we went to break, we were just talking about the most people have heard of the Shroud of Turin. There's also another cloth associated with the burial of Jesus, mentioned, by the way, in the Gospel of John, which was a cloth that was just covering the face of Jesus. And this is called the Sudarium of Oviedo. That's because that's where it's kept, just like the Shroud of Turin.
Sudarium is like sweat cloth, mini shroud, tiny shroud, whatever you want. Right. Be like a giant handkerchief, basically.
Yeah. And so this is placed over the face of Christ, according to tradition. And when you read in the Gospels where when Peter and, quote, the other disciple, which is John's adroit way of referring to himself, arrive at the tomb, John gets there first, probably because he's younger, and he looks in, and then Peter goes into the tomb. And they notice there's something about the grave clothes in the Gospel of John that John finds notable. It says that when he saw the grave clothes, this, by the way, is something a priest at our parish pointed out, which I'd never thought about before. He said, Jesus made his bed, which I never thought about before. But right. But the grave clothes are like neatly folded up, and the head cloth, the sudarium, is set aside. So it's not just like sometimes you'll see paintings of just sort of a wad of grave clothes there in the corner of the tomb. And he pointed out that it may be perfectly possible. It may be, my priest pointed out that it may be that part of what John noticed was simply that this was something that Jesus was known for. You know how you know people's personal habits? They're just the people that you, there are people that you know that they just, they would die rather than not make their bet.
Right.
So my priest was speculating a little bit that maybe it was just that quirk of folding up his own grave clothes that persuaded John that Jesus was raised. Because it says that he saw and believed. And, then it goes on, it says he didn't yet know from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. And so there's that quirky statement. But in addition, of course, there's this curious Catholic tradition about the Shroud of Turin and the Sudarium, both of these pieces of cloth. And there was a conference that was recently held in Spain in which they looked at these two cloths. And the Sudarium, which was supposedly over the face of Jesus, has blood stains that map really well to the blood stains that are on the Shroud of Turin.
Right, to the wounds that are shown, yeah. And the whole pattern of the facial features and how the blood would have flowed.
Right. And so
it suggests a massive area of bleeding around the nose, because there's a large, if you look at the Sudarium, and you could pull up pictures of it easily, it's spelled just like it sounds on the internet. You'll see that there's kind of a butterfly kind of effect there of blood on either side of an area that's clear, that looks like maybe the tip of a nose or something that was a little elevated, and then area around the mouth and nose that was bleeding, and then some other areas off to the side that suggest that they're mapped roughly to the shroud. And that was, you know, the new announcement.
Yeah. And so that's interesting because, of course, if it's a coincidence, it's a doozy of a coincidence.
Right.
You know, and if it's something even more ridiculous, is claimed like it's a conspiracy. By two completely separate forgers to somehow make their, you know, make their forgeries map to one another. It's like, I just find it easier to believe that Jesus rose from the dead, you know?
There are easier things. Remember, we were going to put a pin in two subjects. There were documentary evidence and radiocarbon dating. Now, the Sudarium has been radiocarbon dated. It has been radiocarbon dated to 700 AD. There's a problem with this, however, and that we have documentary evidence 200 years earlier about the Sudarium.
Really?
So we actually have proof that blows the radiocarbon dating right out of the water. Right. You know, we put too much faith in a lot of things. We're learning now that forensics, especially, you can usually find them on the internet. There's some articles about reconsidering forensic science because things like hair matches and even fingerprints are extremely subjective to and extremely open to interpretation. They are not hard sciences. If people think that matching a hair in a legal case is a hard science, it's not. It has a lot to do with the training of the individual. It has a lot to do with a lot of variables. You know, everyone's like, well, you can't, you know, two people don't have the same hair. Well, it's real sketchy. Right. So radiocarbon dating can be thrown off by a number of different factors, by where the sample was taken and other things. So
also, if your shroud was in a huge fire.
Right. Well, yeah, and they were taking it from the pat. You know, funny thing about fire, produces a lot of carbon.
Yeah, how about this?
You know, and there's a lot of other things, elements that go into cloth and things that can throw radiocarbon dating. It's people act like it's a magic bullet and they wave it around like, I've got the report. And it's, okay, that's a piece of evidence. Right. I will factor that in. But since I have another piece of evidence that makes yours gibberish and mine is locked solid, you know, 570 AD, at least we've got something describing this exact piece of cloth, you know, so your radiocarbon dating is useless now.
There's another curiosity that goes with this, and this is a fascinating thing that happens over and over again in the tradition. You will see numerous attestations to Eucharistic miracles.
Right.
Really things that are just inexplicable. So the miracle of Lanciano. And if you're going to... Lanciano was a Eucharistic miracle that happened, what was it, about 800 or something like this? I forget.
Yeah. You know what? I'm remembering the name. I cannot call it up.
Okay. You can go and look it up on the web. Lanciano. So there's this priest who's having his doubts about the real presence of the Eucharist.
Okay, yeah.
And he consecrates the Eucharist, and looks down at the paten, and where there had been a piece of bread, there is blood and basically a piece of tissue. And so this is preserved by the bishop. It's still there. You can still see it. It's kept as a holy relic. And there have been all these tests done on it. And the two things that show up are this is not merely tissue. This is heart tissue.
It is. It's cardiac tissue. I remember what you're talking about.
It's human cardiac tissue. And the blood is type AB negative. And what's oddly enough, every time you get, and all this, of course, is happening these kinds of things happen multiple times throughout the history of the church, including, by the way, just like
last year
in Poland, right? So just last week, it was announced that, I forget which town in Poland where this happened, but some guy goes up to receive communion on Christmas Day. And something happens. Somebody fumbles the host and it falls on the ground. So the priest picks the host up, and as is the custom, since nobody wants to consume that host, they put it in some water to dissolve it. And the idea is that then you wash the host. You know, when you wash the cup, the host will be washed out onto the ground, which is what you do with
right. There's a special sink. Some people might not realize this, that we should probably explain that. There's mm-hmm. a special sink that goes straight into the ground.
Right. Not into sewer system.
No, that's right. It goes straight into the ground. So, and that's where you wash holy vessels into.
Right. And, so the idea is things go back to nature that God made.
Sure.
So anyway, they put the Eucharist in water to dissolve it. And later on, somebody goes back to wash the thing, and it's the water is red. It's bleeding,
right.
And they test it, and there is, in fact, in the church, a lot of people think that the church is like eager to find these things, and the church always responds to these kinds of events with
Let's see, trust me. One thing the people at the Vatican don't want is more work and more paperwork.
And plus, it's just, there's always some weirdo coming up with some claim of a miracle, right?
Yeah, they don't
And so, and there is, in fact, a kind of mold that can attack a host and turn red.
And we've had it before. There was a Eucharistic miracle just a few years ago. They ballyhooed it. They took it. They finally did the testing. It was red mold. Everybody
was red mold. Well, we'll talk about what happened next in just a minute. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back with Tom McDonald right after this.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Tom McDonald. We're talking a little bit about this is our Arcana Tuesday, so we're talking about the Sudarium of Oviedo, the Shroud of Turin, and most recently, I mean, this was just approved, like last week in Poland. Is it another Eucharistic miracle? So somebody dropped a host, they put it in water to dissolve it so that they could clean the vessels out later. And when they went to do so, they looked in the water was stained red, and it was leaking blood. And so, of course, they did the tests because the church is... contrary to popular opinion, bishops and priests really don't want the headache, man.
They really don't. They don't want the people, because a lot of people are coming up to the Vatican offices saying, can you please look at my Virgin Mary toast?
Right, exactly. There's always people coming. And, you know, there's just, you know, when you have a church of close to a billion people, there's going to be a considerable number of kooks.
Sure, and you're going to have a considerable amount of holy toast,
right? And so, yeah, you're going to get people showing up. You know, tell you that the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared to them and wants the Pope to do X, Y, and Z. And so, the church is always treats this stuff with extreme skepticism and subjects it to all these tests.
And it has to, not just to throw something in here as to why we do it, other than the fact that we're not idiots, is that there's real danger to the faith. I mean, you can look like, who is it? Sure. Maria Divine Mercy? Was that her name? Or whatever she claimed to be channeling the Virgin Mary. And I mean, real toxic stuff.
Yeah, and weird. You know, yeah,
it's real dangerous after a while.
And when it gets out of hand, which it has done in places like Medjugorje, you know, the church has got a real job ahead of it, because when something gets to be popular, even though it is transparently fake, the church then has to like deal with this giant wildfire of popular devotion that goes nuts for these kinds of things. And so anyway, the first instant suspicion when something like this happens is red mold. Red mold is a kind of mold that will attack the host under certain circumstances, and it stains the host red, and people start jumping to conclusions, and this is the blood of Christ, and et cetera. Then it turns out it's just mold. So they tested for that. No, turns out it's blood, human blood, and more than that, the host tested for, again, human cardiac tissue. Not just any tissue. We're not talking cheek scrapings here. We're talking about human heart tissue.
Yeah, cross-striated muscle is how the reports are putting it, which is, right. They're saying most similar to human cardiac tissue is the report. So, I mean, this is, by the way, this isn't, you know, the papal, you know, Department of Credulous Scientists. This is a Department of Forensic Medicine from, I'm not sure who did it, actually. One of the universities
was
asked to do it.
Yeah, it's not like we're going to take this and have it only tested by our incredibly gullible Catholic Department of whatever. You know?
Right. People don't realize that most of the Shroud team was deliberately, I shouldn't say most, a good portion of the Shroud teams that have looked at it up close over the few times it was pulled out for examination were deliberately chosen as non-believers.
Right. So that, you know, because the church isn't stupid. They know that people are going to, you know, these are obvious questions to ask, you know? Right. Anyway, they looked at it, and sure enough, the blood, and it's always this way. Every time there's a Eucharistic miracle that's verified.
Right.
Always AB.
Yeah.
Type AB blood.
Yeah.
And which is a weird and rare kind of blood, you know? So you have to, for all the centuries before the discovery of blood types, which is basically shortly before I was born.
Right.
You have people who have absolutely no knowledge of blood. All just luckily. If this is a fake, they're all just, luckily they happened to, for whatever reason, use the blood of somebody with AB blood.
Right.
Or, alternatively, I'm gonna just throw something out here. Another possibility is that the Shroud and the Sudarium and these miraculous events are in fact miraculous events that God does because God, under carefully controlled laboratory conditions, can do whatever he feels like.
Right.
Which brings us, by the way, to a point that some people have had a difficulty. Well, how can the Sudarium have been over the face of Jesus? Because look at the Shroud of Turin. You could see the face of Jesus on the Shroud of Turin.
Right.
How can it be possible for that to have happened when there was a Sudarium over his face? To which my response is, how can it be possible that there's an image on the Shroud?
Right. I mean,
it's like people who say, I can accept the resurrection, but the virgin birth is just too far out for me. It's like, seriously? <You
know>? Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't understand the levels of skepticism, and I think a lot of them are doctrinally determined, you know, virgin births and, you know, Mary's perpetual virginity and things like that. You know, they emerge out of old theological arguments that people right. just haven't quite shaken off yet. Right. I want to say one thing about the Shroud thing that I've, one of the people involved in the Sudarium conference, and we're not talking five people in a closet. This was like 300, 400 people.
In a closet? Really?
Yeah, in a closet. No, okay. In Spain. At the, what's it, Sindology, I think they call the
right, the International Center of Sindonology.
Sindonology, yes,
a thing. That's a real thing.
Sindonology is the study of the Shroud. Yeah.
Right. It was actually, the conference was held in Turin, but yeah. It was,
Turin? I thought it was Spain. Well, a Spanish sculptor, Juan Manuel Menaro Lopez, is one of the people who gets cited in these stories. I'm not quite sure why, because he's not a scientist. He's a professor of sculpture, but he has a Facebook page under that name, Juan Manuel Menaro Lopez. And what he's done, and I can't stop looking at them, is he's taken the Shroud and he's studied it and he's sculpted life-size, you know, three-dimensional sculptures of Jesus based on those images at different points in the Passion and the Crucifixion. So you can see what the Shroud actually, how it appears in three dimensions. You can see the face, you can see, you know, the position on the flogging and different things like this based on a careful study of the Shroud image itself. And it's like the Shroud brought to life. They're very good sculptures, by the way. They're very obviously completely grisly, so be warned before you get there.
Yeah.
But, you know what? I'll share the link somewhere on my writer page on Facebook because
okay. Yeah, I'd like to see it.
It's they're tremendous sculptures and they're all very much informed by this. You can see because a lot of people had different images. If you look at medieval imagery, it's not. See, that's the funny thing. People make claims for what something is, and you see these skeptics, and they say, "Well, it's just medieval imagery." It's, you know, I said medieval imagery actually has a history. It actually has a science to it. There's actually a discipline of medieval art. You know, right. There's actually people who know how this art developed into the Middle Ages and how it changed. And the flogging patterns, which are very vivid here on these sculptures, especially, this is not common to medieval art. I can tell you flat out,
right?
It doesn't look like medieval art to me. It doesn't look like any way it would have been conceived in the Middle Ages. We had a thought world at the time that the Shroud first makes its appearance, already as an old document in documentary evidence. And by the way, that's only if we ignore other documentary evidence that might point to the Mendelian, another relic being related to the Shroud.
And that's perhaps the same thing. Yeah.
Sure. And that's a whole different subject. Yeah. Do we say that there's no documentary proof? If we connect the Shroud and the Mendelian, then we've got the whole thing going back almost all the way to apostolic time.
There's actually a very interesting, those who are familiar with me in the show know that I'm a big fan of the work of Michael Flynn. He's a science fiction writer by night, statistician by day, Also, just a droll writer about things medieval. And he did a nice series a while back, basically reconstructing. Sometimes with speculation, but also there's a fair amount of support for this. Reconstructing, how did the shroud get from the tomb on Easter morning to France in the middle of the 14th century?
Right.
And there's actually a very reasonable route for the thing to have pursued. You know, certain things just seem to me to be obvious. If you did walk into the tomb on Sunday morning and had encountered, you know, had encountered the risen Christ, or knew people who had encountered the risen Christ, and you see a cloth that has this inexplicable image on it, would you say, well, that's weird, and then walk off and leave it? No, I think you'd keep it, right?
Right.
We'll talk about this more in a minute. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back with Tom McDonald right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Tom McDonald, knower of all things arcane. We're talking about arcane things today. We're talking about the Shroud of Turin. It's a fascinating subject. Not an article of faith for Catholics. Very important to understand that. Understanding the balance between public and private revelation is important, because people can get all screwed up about private revelation and make their private their favorite. There are a lot of people who just, you know, have a real devotion to a given private revelation. So I know people who have a huge devotion to Our Lady of Fatima, or Our Lady of Lourdes, or the Our Lady of Guadalupe, or things like the Shroud of Turin, or, you know, these kinds of things. And that's all great. Knock yourself out. My recommendation is stick with approved revelations, because it will only lead to tears.
Yeah, down the road. Well, there's a story told about Saint Martin is very revered among the Christianity of the Gauls. Saint Martin's a huge figure. A lot of biographies, a lot of miracles attributed to him in his tomb. His first life, his first vita, was written by somebody with the sublime name of Sulpicius Severus. But
he's the defense against the dark.
Yes, I know. That's just it. It's, and it works here too. Okay. What Saint Martin did was he found Christians worshiping at a shrine, and they said it was a martyr who had died for the faith, and there was supposedly all kinds of hysteria around this shrine. Martin did not care for it. So Martin appeared at the shrine and addressed what he called the sordid shadow that was there, and it turned out to be a robber, somebody who was, you know, it was the shade, the demonic shade, or demonically possessed shade of an evil person that demons were using to fake people into having a devotion to somebody who was false. And St. Martin banished him and exorcised him. And this is an example, you know, from the early church. You know, St. Martin was 4th century, roughly. Right. And, you know, we see that going back very early. I mean, that's early in the life of the church, in which we're already seeing people are saying, we've got this revelation here. It's this martyr has spoken. He's healing. And the saint comes along and says, that's a demon. So, okay.
Right. Well, and that goes back to the Book of Acts and Simon Magus.
Oh, sure.
Just because there's something ooky going on doesn't mean it's from God, right? I mean, ooky things happen, sure, you know, and sometimes there really are preternatural things that take place, but you know what? That doesn't necessarily mean it's from God.
And Simon Magus became a very popular figure. Simon Magus One thing about what we call Apocrypha is that it's basically Christian fan fiction.
Right.
They'll take, you know, it's like somebody writing, you know, Harry Potter stories, but in a Christian version. So they'll take minor characters from the Bible and then spin these in the stories. And Simon Magus shows up quite a lot of them. You know, he actually created a following eventually, you know, obviously after his death, of people who thought he was, you know, a seeker of wisdom. The Gnostics kind of had some stuff for him. He appears in the Acts of Peter and the Acts of Peter of Paul and the Pseudo-Clementine literature and all this stuff in medieval legend. So Simon Magus comes from this person who basically wanted to, and it's where we get the word simony, by the way.
Yeah.
He basically wanted to buy his way in.
Hey, that was a cool trick that you performed helping those guys speak in tongues. Can you give me that mojo? Here's some dough.
Right.
That's, that's what he says to Peter. Magus. Yeah, and you know Peter's response. One of those moments in one of those pastoral moments in the church that you don't often find reproduced in the handbooks that teach priests how to do pastoral things. This is where Peter looks at Simon Magus and says, "To hell with you and your money."
Right. And Simon was a Christian. He wasn't a pagan. He had been baptized already. So he was inside. Right. He just thought he could, you know, that's why simony has always been, even though the church practiced it, you know, members of the church practiced it, it's always been a terrible sin.
Yep.
You know, I mean, really way at the top of sins that especially clerics can perform, you know, is trying to buy your way to higher office, which of course, during certain periods of the Middle Ages, they all did.
They did that. Yeah, and so when we look at the tradition of the church, one of the things that we see is there are and always have been and probably always will be claims of extraordinary miraculous events. Sometimes it turns out that those extraordinary and miraculous events are in fact miraculous events.
Sure.
Inexplicable things that God does not to add to the tradition, not to add to what Jesus and the apostles have taught, but rather to get our attention so that we will again see the public revelation that Jesus and the apostles taught us, that it will become alive for us, that we'll go, yikes, God is talking to me. And this is one of the purposes of something like the Shroud of Turin. The Shroud of Turin has been a huge help for the faith of many Catholics, because they look at it and say, I have no explanation for this other than the Catholic explanation. You know, if it's a fake, you know, I've actually heard people say, again, this is just amazing to me. I've heard people say, well, okay, let's grant that it's 2,000 years old, but how do we know that it's Jesus? It could be anybody, right?
Sure.
It's like, what are the odds, right?
What are the odds? They get in smaller and smaller boxes, and they turn and turn, because once you're committed to an idea, I've actually kind of, it's very liberating for me, because I was out of the church for a very long time. I completely rejected the faith. I completely didn't believe any of this, and I stumbled my way back in because I read enough and researched enough and started, you know, I came in totally through the head. It was not a conversion of heart at all until later, until, you know, an experience later did it turn into that. But, you know, when you read enough of it and try to read it with an open mind, you realize there's stuff here that is best explained by the Catholic model, you know, that it's the way to see the world so that the world makes sense. And you say, you know, this actually makes sense of the world. And it was funny. I never read any Chesterton until late in life. And so when I finally found him, he didn't have any effect on my reconversion or relapsing or whatever you want to call it. But it echoed all of me.
Yeah.
Of my experience that I'd had. So
The Shroud of Turin was certainly an important influence for me as I was beginning to look at the Christian faith, because part of what the Christian faith contends is that this stuff did not happen in cloud cuckoo land, that it left not just a paper trail, but if the Catholic faith is to be believed, it left all kinds of breadcrumbs.
Sure.
If
this thing about history is a strange beast because it's, you know, we only know certain things in certain ways from it. But what we see, if we look at it, you know, and I've done this for a long time, you know, since I was a kid. And when you read enough of it, you start to see patterns and you start to see things and right. you start to see kind of the imprint of God in the world. And so you right. start to look for where that makes the most sense, where it really started to come together. And the most logical one, if you look at all the traditions, the most rational history of God in history is the story from Genesis to the birth of the church, you know, yeah. to the apocalypse, because that shows, you know, God's fingerprint in history, right. in leading right. a people. So you see people emerging through, and you read those hard passages of the Bible, and you see the miracles, and you see them coming through these incredible moments and, you know, evolving upward towards the reception of the final testament right. from Jesus.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, I looked at something like the Shroud of Turin as somebody who was just starting to look at the faith, and I thought, I look at it, and I continue to look at it, not as a miracle that the church demands I believe in, but rather as something that, well, again, I look at it as I look at the evidence for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln by John Wilkes Booth. I believe it because just flat-out reason tells me that, you know, this is just really hard to explain in any other way. I mean, are we really to believe that the early church just, you know, somebody just happened to be walking, past an open tomb somewhere, sometime, and it had nothing to do with Jesus, but they looked in there and they found a cloth and they said, well, this total stranger's wounds just happened to match everything that's in our...
Right.
Literature about what happened to Jesus.
And then made up the entire story. That's almost more probable, isn't it?
Yeah,
But the whole Bible comes from... you can think your way into all kinds of absurd corners with these, but
right.
sometimes if you just leave your mind open to the work of God in history, you see really these strange things appear maybe not so strange. You know?
Yeah. And, you know, again, and this brings us back, by the way, to the other pin that we stuck in things, which is... you know, one complaint that's often hear is nobody talks about the image on the shroud in the Bible. If it's not written down, it can't possibly have happened.
And they don't talk about the Trinity either.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just nobody actually functions that way. The Gospels are written and the Epistles are written for very specific purposes. And the fact that they don't mention everything just means that they're not written to talk about everything. The Bible is not the big book of everything. Right. So John says, I mean, we could fill the libraries of the world with stories about Jesus, but I'm telling you this, because this is what you need to know. Hey, Tom McDonald, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening
to... Thanks for having us.
Hey, a pleasure. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back tomorrow with Mr. Rod Bennett. Till then, have a lovely evening. Bye-bye.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.